part of my history on which my charge against the gods chiefly rests, and therefore I must try at any cost to write what is wholly true. Yet it is hard to know perfectly what I was thinking while those huge, silent moments went past. By remembering it too often, I've blurred the memory itself. I suppose my first thought must have been, she's mad. Anyway, my whole heart leaped to shut the door against something monstrously amiss, not to be endured, and to keep it shut. Perhaps I was fighting not to be mad myself. But what I said when I got my breath, and I know my voice came out in a whisper, was simply, "We must go away at once. This is a terrible place." Was I believing in her invisible palace? A Greek will laugh at the thought. But it's different in Gloam. There the gods are too close to us. Up in the mountain, in the very heart of the mountain, where Bardia had been afraid, and even the priests don't go, anything was possible. No door could be kept shut. Yes, that was it. Not plain belief, but infinite misgiving. The whole world, psyche with it, slipping out of my hands. Whatever I meant, she misunderstood me horribly. "So," she said, "you do see it after all." "See what?" I asked. A fool's question, I knew what. "Why, this, this," said Psyche, "the gates, the shining walls." For some strange reason, fury, my father's own fury, fell upon me when she said that. I found myself screaming. I'm sure I had not meant to scream. "Stop it! Stop it at once! There's nothing there!" Her face flushed. For once, and for the moment only, she too was angry. "Well, feel it! Feel it if you can't see!" she cried. "Touch it, slap it, beat your head against it. Here!" She made to grab my hands. I wrenched them free. "Stop it! Stop it, I tell you! There's no such thing. You're pretending. You're trying to make yourself believe it." But I was lying. How did I know whether she really saw invisible things or spoke in madness? Either way, something hateful and strange had begun. As if I could thrust it back by brute force, I fell upon Psyche. Before I knew what I was doing, I had her by the shoulders and was shaking her as one shakes a child. She was too big for that now, and far too strong, stronger than I ever dreamt she could be, and she flung my grip off in a moment. We fell apart, both breathing hard, now more like enemies than ever. All at once a look came into her face that I had never seen there, sharp, suspicious. "But you tasted the wine. Where do you think I got it from?" "Wine? What wine? What are you talking about?" "Oh, well, the wine I gave you, and the cup. I gave you the cup, and where is it? Where have you hidden it?" "Oh, I've done with it, child. I'm in no mood for nonsense. There was no wine." "But I gave it to you. You drank it. And the fine honey cakes you said—" "You gave me water cupped in your hands." "But you praised the wine. And the cup you said—" "I praised your hands. You were playing a game, you know you were, and I fell in with it." She gaped open-mouthed, yet beautiful even then. "So that was all?" she said slowly. "You mean you saw no cup? Tasted no wine?" I wouldn't answer. She'd heard well enough what I said. Presently her throat moved as if she was swallowing something. Oh, the beauty of her throat! She pressed down a great storm of passion, and her mood changed. It was now sober sadness mixed with pity. She struck her breast with her clenched fist as mourners do. "I..." she mourned. "So this is what he meant. You can't see it, you can't feel it. For you it is not there at all. Oh, Maya, I am very sorry." I came almost to a full belief. She was shaking and stirring me a dozen different ways, but I had not shaken her at all. She was as certain of her palace as of the plainest thing, as certain as the priest had been of Ungit when my father's dagger was between his ribs. I was as weak beside her as the fox beside the priest. This valley was indeed a dreadful place, full of the divine, sacred, no place for mortals. There might be 100 things in it that I could not see. Can a Greek understand the horror of that thought? Years after, I dreamed again and again that I was in some well-known place, most often the pillar room, and everything I saw was different from what I touched. I would lay my hand on the table and feel warm hair instead of smooth wood, and the corner of the table would shoot out a hot wet tongue and lick me. And I knew by the mere taste of them that all those dreams came from that moment when I believed I was looking at Psyche's palace and did not see it. For the horror was the same, a sickening discord, a rasping together of two worlds like the two bits of a broken bone. But in the reality, not in the dreams, with the horror came the inconsolable grief. For the world had broken in pieces, and Psyche and I were not in the same piece. Seas, mountains, madness, death itself could not have removed her from me to such a hopeless distance as this. Gods, and again gods, always gods, they had stolen her. They would leave us nothing. A thought pierced up through the crust of my mind like a crocus coming up in the early year. Was she not worthy of the gods? Ought they not to have her? But instantly great choking, blinding waves of sorrow swept it away, and, "Oh," I cried, "it's not right! It's not right! Oh, Psyche, come back! Where are you? Come back! Come back!" She had me in her arms at once. "Maya, sister," she said, "I'm here. Maya, don't, I can't bear it, I'll—" "Yes, oh, my own child, I do feel you, I hold you, but, oh, it's only like holding you in a dream. You are leagues away, and I—" She led me a few paces further, and made me sit down on a mossy bank and sat beside me. With words and touch she comforted me all she could. And as in the centre of a storm or even of a battle I've known sudden stillness for a moment, so now for a little I let her comfort me. Not that I took any heed of what she was saying. It was her voice and her love in her voice that counted. Sometimes, even now, the way she used to say this or that word comes back to me, as warm and real as if she were beside me in the room, the softness of it, the richness, as of corn grown from a deep soil. What was she saying? "And perhaps, Maya, you too will learn how to see. I will beg and implore him to make you able. He will understand. He warned me when I asked for this meeting that it might not turn out all as I hoped. I never thought... I'm only simple Psyche, as he calls me. Never thought he meant you wouldn't even see it. So he must have known. He'll tell us." "He?" I'd forgotten this "him." Or if not forgotten, left him out of account ever since you first told me we were standing at his palace gates. And now she was saying "he" every moment, no other name but "he," the way young wives talk. Something began to grow colder and harder inside me. And this also is like what I've known in wars, when that which was only "they" or "the enemy" all at once becomes the man 2 feet away who means to kill you. "Who are you talking of?" I asked. But I meant, "Why do you talk of him to me? What have I to do with him?" "But, Maya," she said, "I've told you all my story. My God, of course, my lover, my husband, the master of my house." "Oh, I can't bear it," said I, leaping up. Those last words of hers, spoken softly and with trembling, set me on fire. I could feel my rage coming back. Then, like a great light, a hope of deliverance, it came to me. I asked myself why I'd forgotten and how long I'd forgotten that first notion of her being mad. Madness! Of course the whole thing must be madness. I'd been nearly as mad as she to think otherwise. At the very name madness, the air of that valley seemed more breathable, seemed emptied of a little of its holiness and horror. "Have done with it, Psyche," I said sharply. "Where is this god? Where the palace is? Nowhere. In your fancy? Where is he? Show him to me. What is he like?" She looked a little aside and spoke, lower than ever, but very clear, and as if all that had yet passed between us were of no account beside the gravity of what she was now saying. "Oh, Orawal," she said, "not even I have seen him yet. He comes to me only in the holy darkness. He says I mustn't, not yet, see his face or know his name. I'm forbidden to bring any light into his, our chamber. Then she looked up, and as our eyes met for a moment, I saw in hers unspeakable joy. "There's no such thing," I said, loud and stern. "Never say these things again. Get up. It's time—" "Orwell," said she, now at her queenliest, "I have never told you a lie in my life." I tried to soften my manner, yet the words came out cold and stern. "No, you don't mean to lie. You're not in your right mind, Psyche. You have imagined things. It's the terror and the loneliness and that drug they gave you. We'll cure you."
"Orwell," said she.
"What?"
"If it's all my fancy, how do you think I've lived these many days? Do I look as if I'd fed on berries and slept under the sky? Are my arms wasted or my cheeks fallen in?"
I would, I believe, have lied to her myself and said they were, but it was impossible. From the top of her head to her naked feet she was bathed in life and beauty and well-being. It was as if they flowed over her or from her. It was no wonder Bardia had worshipped her as a goddess. The very rags served only to show more of her beauty. All the honey sweetness, all the rose red and the ivory, the warm, breathing perfection of her. She even seemed—but that's impossible, I thought—taller than before. And as my lie died unspoken, she looked at me with something like mockery in her face. Her mocking looks had always been some of her loveliest.
"You see," she said, "it's all true. And that—no, listen, Maya, that's why all will come right. We'll make—he will make you able to see, and then—"
"I don't want it," I cried, putting my face close to hers, threatening her almost, till she drew back before my fierceness. "I don't want it. I hate it. Hate it, hate it, hate it. Do you understand?"
"But, Orwell, why? What do you hate?"
"Oh, the whole—" "What can I call it? You know very well, or you used to. This—" And then something she'd said about him, hardly noticed till now, began to work horribly in my mind. "This thing that comes to you in the darkness, and you're forbidden to see it? Holy darkness, you call it? What sort of thing? Ugh, it's like living in the house of Ungit. Everything's dark about the gods. I think I can smell the very—" The steadiness of her gaze, the beauty of her, so full of pity, yet in a way so pitiless, made me dumb for a moment. Then my tears broke out again. "Oh, Psyche," I sobbed, "you're so far away. Do you even hear me? I can't reach you. Oh, Psyche, Psyche, you loved me once. Come back. What have we to do with gods and wonders and all these cruel, dark things? We're women, aren't we? Mortals. Oh, come back to the real world. Leave all that alone. Come back where we were happy."
"But, Orwell, think. How can I go back? This is my home. I am a wife."
"Wife of what?" said I, shuddering.
"If you only knew him," she said.
"You like it? Oh, Psyche!" She would not answer me. Her face flushed. Her face and her whole body were the answer. "Oh, you ought to have been one of Ungit's girls," said I savagely. "You ought to have lived in there, in the dark, all blood and incense and muttering and the reek of burnt fat. To like it? Living among things you can't see, dark and holy and horrible? Is it nothing to you at all that you're leaving me, going into all that, turning your back on all our love?"
"No, no, Maya, I can't go back to you. How could I? But you must come to me."
"Oh, it's madness," said I.
Was it madness or not? Which was true? Which would be worse?
I was at that very moment when, if they meant us well, the gods would speak. Mark what they did instead. It began to rain. It was only a light rain, but it changed everything for me. "Here, child," said I, "come under my cloak. Your poor rags. Quick, you'll be wet through." She gazed at me wonderingly.
"How should I get wet, Maya," she said, "when we're sitting indoors with a roof above us? And rags! But I forgot you can't see my robes, either."
The rain shone on her cheeks as she spoke. If that wise Greek who is to read this book doubts that this turned my mind right round, let him ask his mother or wife.
The moment I saw her, my child, whom I had cared for all her life, sitting there in the rain, as if it meant no more to her than it does to cattle. The notion that her palace and her god could be anything but madness was at once unbelievable. All those wilder misgivings, all the fluttering to and fro between two opinions, was for that time quite over. I saw in a flash that I must choose one opinion or the other, and in the same flash knew which I had chosen. "Psyche," I said, and my voice had changed. "This is sheer raving. You can't stay here. Winter'll be on us soon. It'll kill you." "I cannot leave my home, Maya." "Home? There is no home here. Get up. Here, under my cloak." She shook her head a little wearily. "It's no use, Maya," she said. "I see it and you don't. Who's to judge between us?"
"I'll call Bardia."
"I'm not allowed to let him in, and he wouldn't come."
That I knew was true.
"Get up, girl," I said. "Do you hear me? Do as you're told. Psyche, you never disobeyed me before."
She looked up, wetter every moment, and said, very tender in voice, but hard as a stone in her determination,
"Dear Maya, I am a wife now. It's no longer you that I must obey."
I learned then how one can hate those one loves. My fingers were round her wrist in an instant, my other hand on her upper arm. We were struggling.
"You shall come," I panted. "We'll force you away, hide you somewhere. Bardia has a wife, I believe. Lock you up. His house bring you to your senses."
It was useless. She was far stronger than I. Of course, I thought, they say mad people have double strength. We left marks on one another's skin. There was a thick, tangled sort of wrestling. Then we were apart again, she staring with reproach and wonder, I weeping as I had wept at her prison door, utterly broken with shame and despair. The rain had stopped. It had, I suppose, done all the gods wanted. And now there was nothing at all left that I could do. Psyche, as always, recovered herself first. She laid her hand, there was a smear of blood on it, was it possible I could have scratched her, across my shoulder.
"Dear Maya," she said, "you have very seldom been angry with me in all the years I can remember. Do not begin now. Look, the shadows have already crept nearly all the way across the courtyard. I had hoped that before this we should have feasted together and been merry. But there, you would have tasted only berries and cold water. Bread and onions with Bardia will be more comfort to you. But I must send you away before the sun sets. I promised that I would."
"Are you sending me away forever, Psyche, and with nothing?"
"Nothing, Orua, but a bidding to come again as soon as you can. I'll work for you here. There must be some way. And then, oh, Maya, then we shall meet here again with no cloud between us. But now you must go."
What could I do but obey her? In body she was stronger than I. Her mind I could not reach. She was already leading me back to the river, back through the desolate valley she called her palace. The valley looked hideous to me now. There was a chill in the air. Sunset flamed up behind the black mass of the saddle. She clung to me at the very edge of the water.
"You will come back soon, soon," she said.
"If I can, Psyche. You know how it is in our house."
"I think," said she, "the king will not be much hindrance to you in the next few days. Now, there's no more time. Kiss me again, dear Maya. And now lean on my hand. Feel for the flat stone with your foot."
Again I endured the sword cut of the icy water. From this side I looked back.
"Psyche! Psyche!" I broke out. "There's still time. Come with me. Anywhere. I'll smuggle you out of Gloam. We'll go for beggar women all over the world. Or you can go to Bardia's house. Anywhere, anything you like."
She shook her head.
"How could I?" she said. "I'm not my own. You forget, sister, that I'm a wife. Yet always yours, too. Oh, if you knew, you'd be happy. Orwell, don't look so sad. All will be well, all will be better than you can dream of. Come again soon. Farewell for a little."
She went away from me into her terrible valley, and out of sight finally among the trees.
It was already deep twilight on my side of the river, close in under the shadow of the saddle. "Bardia," I called. "Bardia, where are you?"
Chapter 12. Bardia, a grey shape in the twilight, came towards me. "You have left the Blessed," he said.
"Yes," said I. I could not talk to him about it, I thought.
"Then we must speak of how to spend our night. We'd never find a way for the horse up to the saddle now, and if we did, we'd have to go down again beyond the tree into the other valley. We couldn't sleep on the saddle itself. Too much wind. It'll be cold enough here, where we're sheltered, in an hour or so. I fear we must lie here. Not where a man'd choose, too near the gods."
"What does it matter?" said I. "It will do as well as anywhere else."
"Then come with me, lady. I've gathered a few sticks."
I followed him, and in that silence, there was nothing now but the chattering of the stream, and it seemed louder than ever. We could hear, long before we came to the horse, the sound of the grass torn up by his teeth. A man and a soldier is a wonderful creature. Bardia had chosen a place where the bank was steepest, and two rocks close together made the next best thing to a cave. The sticks were all laid and the fire alight, though still sputtering from the late rain. And he brought out of the saddlebags things better than bread and onions, even a flask of wine. I was still a girl, which in many matters is the same thing as a fool, and it seemed to me shameful that in all my sorrow and care I was so eager for the food when it came. I never tasted better. And that meal in the firelight, which had made all the rest of the world a mere darkness as soon as it blazed up, seemed to me very sweet and homelike. Mortal food and warmth for mortal limbs and bellies. No need for a space to think of gods and riddles and wonders. When we had ended, Bardia said somewhat shamefacedly,
"Lady, you're not used to lying in the open, and you might be cruelly chill before day. So I'll make so free, for I'm no more to you, lady, than one of your father's big dogs, as to say we'd best lie close, back to back, the way men do in the wars, and both cloaks over us."
I said yes to that, and indeed no woman in the world has so little reason as I to be chary in such matters. Yet it surprised me that he should have said it, for I did not yet know that, if you're ugly enough, all men, unless they hate you deeply, soon give up thinking of you as a woman at all.
Bardia rested as soldiers do, dead asleep in two breaths, but ready, I've seen him tested since, to be wide awake in one, if need were.
I think I never slept at all. First there was the hardness and slope of the ground, and after that the cold. And besides these, fast and whirling thoughts, wakeful as a madman's, about Psyche and my hard riddle, and also of another thing. At last the cold grew so bitter that I slipped from under the cloak. Its outer side was wet with dew by now, and began walking to and fro. And now let that wise Greek, whom I look to as my reader and the judge of my cause, mark well what followed. It was already twilight, and there was much mist in the valley. The pools of the river, as I went down to it to drink, for I was thirsty as well as cold, seemed to be dark holes in the greyness. And I got my drink, ice cold, and I thought it steadied my mind. But would a river flowing in the god's secret valley do that, or the clean contrary? This is another of the things to be guessed. For when I lifted my head and looked once more into the mist across the water, I saw that which brought my heart into my throat. There stood the palace, grey, as all things were grey in that hour and place, but solid and motionless, wall within wall, pillar and arch and architrave, acres of it, a labyrinthine beauty. As she had said, it was like no house ever seen in our land or age. Pinnacles and buttresses leaped up. No memories of mine, you would think, could help me to imagine them. Unbelievably tall and slender, pointed and prickly as if stone were shooting out into branch and flower. No light showed from any window. It was a house asleep. And somewhere within it, asleep also, someone or something, how holy or horrible or beautiful or strange, with Psyche in its arms. And I, what had I done and said? What would it do to me for my blasphemies and unbelievings? I never doubted that I must now cross the river, or try to cross it, even if it should drown me. I must lie on the steps at the great gate of that house and make my petition. I must ask forgiveness of Psyche as well as of the god. I had dared to scold her. Dared, what was worse, to try to comfort her as a child. But all the time she was far above me, herself now hardly mortal, if what I saw was real. I was in great fear. Perhaps it was not real. I looked and looked to see if it would not fade or change. Then, as I rose, for all this time I was still kneeling where I had drunk, almost before I stood on my feet the whole thing was vanished. There was a tiny space of time in which I thought I could see how some swirlings of the mist had looked for the moment like towers and walls. But very soon, no likeness at all. I was staring simply into fog, and my eyes smarting with it. And now, you who read, give judgment. That moment when I either saw or thought I saw the house, does it tell against the gods or against me? Would they, if they answered, make it a part of their defence? Say it was a sign, a hint, beckoning me to answer the riddle one way rather than the other? I'll not grant them that. What is the use of a sign which is itself only another riddle? It might, I'll allow so much, it might have been a true seeing. The cloud over my mortal eyes may have been lifted for a moment. It might not. What would be easier than for one distraught, and not, maybe, so fully waking she seemed, gazing at a mist in a half-light to fancy what had filled her thoughts for so many hours? What easier, even, than for the gods themselves to send the whole furly for a mockery? Either way, there's divine mockery in it. They set the riddle, and then allow a seeming that can't be tested, and can only quicken and thicken the tormenting whirlpool of your guesswork. If they had an honest intention to guide us, why is their guidance not plain? Psyche could speak plain when she was three. Do you tell me the gods have not yet come so far? When I came back to Bardia, he was just awake. I did not tell him what I had seen. Until I wrote it in this book, I have never told it to anyone. Our journey down was comfortless, for there was no sun and the wind was always in our faces, with scudding showers at times. I, sitting behind Bardia, got less of it than he. We halted somewhere about noon under the lee of a small wood to eat what was left of our food. Of course, my riddle had been working in my mind all morning, and it was there, out of the wind for a little and somewhat warmer. Was Psyche warm, and worse weather soon to come? That I made up my mind to tell him the whole story, always excepting that moment when I looked into the mist. I knew he was an honest man and secret, and in his own way wise. He listened to it all very diligently, but said nothing when I had ended. I had to draw his answer out of him. "How do you read it all, Bardia?" "Lady," says he, "it's not my way to say more than I can help of gods and divine matters. I'm not impious. I wouldn't eat with my left hand, or lie with my wife when the moon's full, or slit open a pigeon to clean it with an iron knife, or do anything else that's unchancy and profane, even if the king himself were to bid me. And as for sacrifices, I've always done all that can be expected of a man on my pay. But for anything more, I think the less Bardia meddles with the gods, the less they'll meddle with Bardia." But I was determined to have his counsel. "Bardia," I said, "do you think my sister is mad?" "Look, lady," he answered, "there at your very first word you say what's better unsaid. Mad, the blessed, mad. Moreover, we've seen her, and anyone could tell she was in her right mind." "Then you think there really was a palace in the valley, though I couldn't see it?" "I don't well know what's really, when it comes to houses of gods. And what of this lover who comes to her in the dark?" "I say nothing about him." "Oh, Bardia, and among the spears men say you're the bravest. Are you afraid even to whisper your thought to me? I am in desperate need of counsel." "'Counsel about what, lady? What is there to do?' "'How do you read this riddle? Does anyone really come to her?'
"'She says so, lady. Who am I to give the blessed one the lie?'
"'Who is he?'
"'She knows that best.
She knows nothing. She confesses she's never seen him. Bardia, what kind of a lover must this be who forbids his bride to see his face?'
Bardia was silent. He had a pebble between his thumb and forefinger and was drawing little scratches in the earth.'
"'Well?' said I.
"'There doesn't seem to be much of a riddle about it,' he said at last.
"'Then what's your answer?'
"'I should say, speaking as mortal man, and likely enough the gods know better, "'I should say it was one whose face and form would give her little pleasure if she saw them.
"'Some frightful thing?'
"'They called her the Bride of the Brute Lady.' "'But it's time we were riding again. "'We're not much better than halfway home.' "'He got up as he spoke. "'His thought was not new to me. "'It was only the most horrible of the guesses "'which had been jostling and wrangling in my head. "'But the shock of hearing it from his lips lay in this, "'that I knew he had no doubt of it. "'I'd come to know Bardia very well by now.' And I could clearly see that all my difficulty in drawing out his answer came from his fear to say the thing and not from any uncertainty. As he had said, my riddle was no riddle to him. And it was as though all the people of Gloam had spoken to me through him. As he thought, so doubtless every prudent, God-fearing man of our nation and our time would think, too. My other guesses would not even come into their minds. Here was the plain answer, clear as noonday, why seek further? The god and the shadow brute were all one. She'd been given to it. We'd got our rain and water and, as seemed likely, peace with Fars. The gods, for their share, had her away into their secret places, where something so foul it would not show itself, some holy and sickening thing, ghostly or demon-like or bestial, or all three, there's no telling with gods, enjoyed her at its will. I was so dashed that as we continued our journey, nothing in me even fought against this answer of Bardia's. I felt as I suppose a tortured prisoner feels when they dash water in his face to rouse him from his faint, and the truth, worse than all his fantasies, becomes clear and hard and unmistakable again around him. It now seemed to me that all my other guesses had been only self-pleasing dreams spun out of my wishes, but now I was awake. There never had been any riddle. The worst was the truth, and truth as plain as the nose on a man's face. Only terror would have blinded me to it so long. My hand stole to the sword-hilt under my cloak. Before my sickness I had sworn that, if there were no other way, I would have killed Psyche rather than leave her to the heat or hunger of a monster. Now again I made a deep resolve. I was half frightened— when I perceived what I was resolving. So it might come even to that, my heart said, even to killing her. Bardia had already taught me the straight thrust and where to strike. Then my tenderness came over me again, and I cried never more bitterly, till I could not tell whether it was tears or rain that had most drenched my veil. It was settling down to steadier rain as the day went on. And in that tenderness I even asked myself why I should save her from the brute, or warn her against the brute, or meddle with the matter at all. "'She is happy,' said my heart. "'Whether it's madness, or a god, or a monster, or whatever it is, she is happy. You have seen that for yourself. She is 10 times happier there in the mountain than you could ever make her. Leave her alone. Don't spoil it. Don't mar what you've learned you can't make.' We were down in the foothills now, almost, if one could have seen through the rain, in sight of the house of Ungit. My heart did not conquer me. I perceive now that there is a love deeper than theirs who seek only the happiness of their beloved. Would a father see his daughter happy as a whore? Would a woman see her lover happy as a coward? My hand went back to the sword. "'She shall not,' I thought. "'Come what might, she should not. However things might go, whatever the price, by her death or mine or a thousand deaths, by fronting the gods, beard to beard, as the soldiers say, Psyche should not, least of all contentedly, make sport for a demon. We are king's daughters still, I said. I'd hardly said it when I had good cause to remember, in a different fashion, that I was a king's daughter, and what king's? For now we were fording the Shenet again, and Bardia, whose mind was ever on next things, was saying that when we had passed the city, and before we had reached the palace, I had best slip off the horse and go up that little lane, where Redival first saw Psyche being worshipped, and so through the gardens and into the women's quarters by the back way. For it was easy to guess how my father would take it if he found that I, supposed too sick to work with him in the pillar room, had journeyed to the holy tree. Chapter 13. It was nearly dark in the palace, and as I came to my chamber door, a voice said in Greek, "Well?" It was the fox, who had been squatting there, as my women told me, like a cat at a mouse-hole. "Alive, grandfather," said I, and kissed him. "Then, come back as soon as you can. I'm wet as a fish, and must wash and change and eat. I'll tell you all when you come." When I was reclothed and finishing my supper, his knock came at the door. I made him come and sit with me at table and poured him drink. There was no one with us but little Pooby, my dark-skinned maid, who was faithful and loving and knew no Greek. "You said alive," the fox began, raising his cup. "See, I make a libation to Zeus the Saviour." He did it, Greek fashion, with a clever twist of the cup that lets fall just one drop. "Yes, grandfather. Alive and well, and says she's happy." "I feel as if my heart would crack for joy, child," said he. "You tell me things almost beyond belief." "You've had the sweet, grandfather, the sour to follow." "Let me hear it. All is to be borne." Then I told him the whole story, always excepting that one glimpse in the fog. It was dreadful to me to see the light die out of his face as I went on, and to feel that I was darkening it. And I asked myself, if you can hardly bear to do this, how will you bear to wipe out Psyche's happiness? "Alas, alas, poor Psyche," said the fox, "our little child, and how she must have suffered. Hellebore's the right medicine, with rest and peace and loving care. Oh, we'd bring her into frame again, I don't doubt it, if we could nurse her well. But how are we to give her all or any of the things she needs? My wits are dry, daughter. We must think, though, contrive. I wish I were Odysseus, I, or Hermes." "You think, then, she's mad, for certain?" He darted a quick glance at me. "Why, daughter, what then have you been thinking?" "You call it folly, I suppose, but you weren't with her, grandfather. She talked so calmly. There was nothing disordered in her speech. She could laugh merrily. Her glance wasn't wild. If I'd had my eyes shut, I would have believed her palace was as real as this."
"But your eyes being open, you saw no such thing."
"You don't think, not possibly not as a mere hundredth chance, there might be things that are real, though we can't see them?"
"Certainly I do. Such things as justice, equality, the soul, or musical notes."
"Oh, grandfather, I don't mean things like that. If there are souls, could there not be soul houses?" He ran his hands through his hair with an old familiar gesture of teacher's dismay.
"Child," he said, "you make me believe that after all these years you have never even begun to understand what the word soul means."
"I know well enough what you mean by it, grandfather. But do you, even you, know all? Are there no things, I mean things, but what we see?"
"Plenty. Things behind our backs, things too far away, and all things if it's dark enough."
He leaned forward and put his hand on mine.
"I begin to think, daughter, that if I can get that hellebore, yours had better be the first dose," he said.
I had had half a thought at the outset of telling him about the Furley, my glimpse of the palace, but I couldn't bring myself to it. He was the worst hearer in the world for such a story. Already he was making me ashamed of half the things I had been thinking. And now a more cheering thought came to me. "Then, perhaps," said I, "this lover who comes to her in darkness is also part of the madness."
"I wish I could believe it," said the fox.
"Why not, Grandfather?"
"You say she's plump and rosy, not starveling?"
"Never better."
"Then who's fed her all this time?"
I was silenced.
"And who took her out of the irons?"
I'd never thought of this question at all. "Grandfather," I said, "what is in your mind? You of all men, are not hinting that it is a god. You'd laugh at me if I said so."
"I'd be more likely to weep. Oh, child, 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 when shall I have washed the nurse and the grandam and the priest and the soothsayer out of your soul? Do you think the divine nature... Why, it's profane, ridiculous. You might as well say the universe itched, or the nature of things sometimes tippled in the wine cellar."
"I haven't said it was a god, Grandfather," said I. "I'm asking who you think it was."
A man, of course," said the fox, beating his hands on the table. "What, are you still a child? Didn't you know there were men on the mountain?"
"Men?" I gasped.
"Yes, vagabonds, broken men, outlaws, thieves. Where are your wits?"
Indignation came burning into my cheeks, and I sprang up. For any daughter of our house to mix, even in lawful marriage, with those who have not, at least by one grandparent, divine descent, is an utter abomination. The fox's thought was unendurable. "What are you saying?" I asked him. "Psyche would die on sharp stakes sooner than—"
"Peace, daughter," said the fox. "Psyche doesn't know. As I read it, some robber or runaway has found the poor child, half crazed with terror and loneliness, and with thirst too, likely enough, and got her out of her irons. And if she were not in her right mind, what would she most probably babble of in her ravings? Her gold and amber house on the mountain, of course. She's had that fantasy from her childhood. The fellow would fall in with it. He'd be the god's messenger. Why, that's where her god of the west wind comes from. It would be the man himself. He'd take her to this valley. He'd whisper to her that the god, the bridegroom, would come to her that night. And after dark he'd come back."
"But the palace?"
"Her old fantasy, raised up by her madness and taken by her for reality. And whatever she tells the rascal about her fine house, he echoes it all, perhaps adds more of his own. And so the delusion is built up stronger and stronger."
For the second time that day I was utterly aghast. The fox's explanation seemed too plain and evident to allow me any hope of doubt. While Bardia was speaking, his had seemed the same. "It looks, Grandfather," said I dully, "as if you had read the riddle right."
"It needed no Oedipus. But the real riddle's still to guess. What must we do?" "Oh, I'm barren, barren. I think your father has addled my brains with beating me about the ears. There must be some way, yet we've so little time.
And so little freedom. I can't pretend to be on my sickbed much longer. And once the king knows I'm whole, how shall I ever get to the mountain again?"
"Oh, for that. But I'd forgotten. There's been news today. The lions have been seen again."
"What?" I cried in terror. "On the mountain?"
"No, no, not so bad as that. Indeed, rather good than bad. Somewhere down south and west of Ringall, the king will have a great lion hunt."
"The lion's back. So Ungit has played us false after all. Perhaps he'll sacrifice Redivar this time. Is the king in a great rage?"
"Rage? No. Why, you'd think the loss of a herdsman, and what he values far more, some of the best dogs, and I don't know how many bullocks, was the best news he'd ever heard. I never saw him in better spirits. There's been nothing in his mouth all day but dogs and beaters and weather, and such rummage and bustle, messages to this lord and that lord, deep talks with the huntsmen, inspecting of kennels, shoeing of horses, beer flowing like water. Even I have been slapped on the back in pure good fellowship till my ribs ache with it. But what concerns us is that he'll be out at the hunting the next 2 days at least. With luck it might be 5 or 6.
"Then that's the time we have to work in."
"No more than that. He goes at daybreak tomorrow. And anyway, we'd have little longer. She'll die if winter catches her on the mountain, living without a roof. And she'll be with a child, no doubt, before we've time to look about us."
It was as if I'd been hit about the heart. "Leprosy and scabs on the man!" I gasped. "Curse him, curse him! Psyche to carry a beggar's brat!
We'll have him impaled if ever we catch him. He shall die for days. Oh, I could tear his body with my bare teeth. You darken our counsels and your own soul with these passions, said the fox. If there were any way she could lie hidden, if we could get her. I had thought, said I, we could hide her in Bardia's house. Bardia? He'd never take one who's been sacrificed into his house. He's afraid of his own shadow where gods and old wives' tales are concerned. He's a fool.
That he is not, said I sharply enough, for the fox often nettled me with his contempt for very brave and honest people if they had no tincture of his Greek wisdom.
And if Bardia would, the fox added, that wife of his wouldn't let him, and everyone knows that Bardia is tied to his wife's apron strings.
Bardia? And such a man? I couldn't have believed.
Pah! He's as amorous as Alcibiades. Why, the fellow married her undowered, for her beauty, if you please. The whole town knows of it, and she rules him like a slave.
She must be a very vile woman, grandfather.
What does it matter to us whether she is or no? But you needn't think to find refuge for our darling in that house. I'll go further, daughter. There's nothing for it but to send her right out of Gloam. If anyone in Gloam knew that she had not died, they would seek her out and sacrifice her again. If we could get her to her mother's family. But I see no way of doing it. Oh, Zeus, Zeus, Zeus! If I had 10 hoplites and a sane man to command them.
I can't see, said I, even how to get her to leave the mountain. She was obstinate, grandfather. She obeys me no more. I think we must use force.
And we have no force. I am a slave and you are a woman. We can't lead a dozen spears up the mountain. And if we could, the secret would never be kept.
After that we sat silent for a long time, the fire flickering, Pooby sitting cross-legged by the hearth, feeding the logs into it, and playing a strange game of her own people's with beads. She once tried to teach it to me, but I could never learn. The fox made as if to speak a dozen times, but always checked himself. He was quick to devise plans, but no less quick to see the faults in them. At last I said, "It all comes to this, grandfather. I must go back to Psyche. I must overrule her somehow. Once she is on our side, once she knows her shame and danger, then the three of us must devise as best we can. It may be that she and I must go out into the wide world together, wander like Oedipus."
"And I with you," said the fox. "You once bade me run away. This time I'll do it."
"One thing certain," said I, "she shall not be left to the felon who has abused her. I will choose any way, rather than that. It rests on me. Her mother's dead. What mother but me has she ever known? Her father's nothing, nothing for a father and nothing for a king either. The honour of our house, the very being of Psyche, only I am left to care for them. She shall not be left.
What, child? You are pale. Are you fainting?
If there is no other way, I will kill her.
Bye-bye, said the fox,
so loud that Pooby stopped her game and stared at him.
"Daughter, daughter, you are transported beyond all reason and nature. Do you know what it is? There's one part love in your heart, and 5 parts anger, and 7 parts pride. The gods know I love Psyche, too, and you know it. You know I love her as well as you do. It's a bitter grief that our child, our very Artemis and Aphrodite all in one, should live a beggar's life and lie in a beggar's arms. Yet even this... it is not to be named beside such detested impieties as you speak of. Why, look at it squarely, as reason and nature have made it, not as passion would paint it. To be poor and in hardship, to be a poor man's wife.
Wife? You mean his trull, his drab, his whore, his slut?
Nature knows nothing of these names. What you call marriage is by law and custom not nature. Nature's marriage is but the union of the man who persuades with the woman who consents, and so...
the man who persuades, or more likely forces or deceives, being some murderer, alien, traitor, runaway slave or other filth?
Filth? Perhaps I do not see it as you do. I am an alien and a slave myself, and ready to be a runaway, to risk the flogging and impaling for your love and hers.
"You are 10 times my father," said I, raising his hand to my lips. "I meant no such thing. But, grandfather, there are matters you don't understand. Psyche said so herself."
"Sweet Psyche," he said, "I have often told her so. I'm glad she has mastered the lesson. She was ever a good pupil."
"You don't believe in the divine blood of our house," I said.
"Oh, yes, of all houses. All men are of divine blood, for there is the God in every man. We are all one, even the man who has taken Psyche. I have called him rascal and villain. Too likely he is, but it may not be. A good man might be an outlaw and a runaway."
I was silent. All this meant nothing to me.
"Daughter," said the fox suddenly,
"I think no woman, at least no woman who loved you, would have done it.
Sleep comes early to old men. I can hardly keep my eyes open. Let me go. Perhaps we shall see more clearly in the morning."
What could I do but send him away? This is where men, even the trustiest, fail us. Their heart is never so wholly given to any matter but that some trifle of a meal or a drink or a sleep or a joke or a girl may come in between them and it. And then, even if you're a queen, you'll get no more good out of them till they've had their way. In those days I had not yet understood this. Great desolation came over me. "Everyone goes from me," I said. "None of them cares for Psyche. She lives at the very outskirts of their thoughts. She is less to them, far less, than Pooby is to me. They think of her a little and then get tired and go to something else. The fox to his sleep and Bardia to his doll or scold of a wife. You are alone, Orwell. Whatever is to be done, you must devise and do it. No help will come. All gods and mortals have drawn away from you. You must guess the riddle. Not a word will come to you until you have guessed wrong, and they all come crowding back to accuse and mock and punish you for it." I sent Pooby to bed. Then I did a thing which I think few have done. I spoke to the gods myself, alone, in such words as came to me, not in a temple and without a sacrifice. I stretched myself face downward on the floor, and called upon them with my whole heart. I took back every word I'd said against them. I promised anything they might ask of me, if only they would send me a sign. They gave me none. When I began, there was red firelight in the room and rain on the roof. When I rose up again, the fire had sunk a little lower, and the rain drummed on as before. Now, when I knew that I was left utterly to myself, I said, "I must do it, whatever I do, tomorrow. I must then rest tonight." I lay down on the bed. I was in that state when the body is so tired that sleep comes soon, but the mind is in such anguish that it will wake you the moment the body's sated. It woke me a few hours past midnight, with no least possibility of further sleep in me. The fire was out, the rain had stopped. I went to my window and stood looking out into the gusty blackness, twisting my hair in my fists with my knuckles against my temples, and thought. My mind was much clearer. I now saw that I had, strangely, taken both Bardia's explanation and the fox's, each while it lasted, for certain truth. Yet one must be false, and I could not find out which, for each was well rooted in its own soil. If the things believed in Gloam were true, then what Bardia said stood. If the fox's philosophy were true, what the fox said stood. But I could not find out whether the doctrines of Gloam or the wisdom of Greece were right. I was the child of Gloam and the pupil of the fox. I saw that for years my life had been lived in two halves, never fitted together. I must give up, then, trying to judge between Bardia and my master. And as soon as I said that, I saw, and wondered I had not seen before, that it made no difference. For there was one point on which both agreed. Both thought that some evil or shameful thing had taken Psyche for its own. Murdering thief or spectral shadow brute, did it matter which?
The one thing neither of them believed was that anything good or fair came to her in the night. No one but myself had dallied with that thought even for a moment. Why should they? Only my desperate wishes could have made it seem possible. The thing came in darkness and forbade itself to be seen. What lover would shun his bride's eyes unless he had some terrible reason for it? Even I had thought the opposite only for an instant, while I looked at that likeness of a house across the river. "It shall not have her," I said. "She shall not lie in those detestable embraces. Tonight must be the last night of that." Suddenly there rose up before me the memory of Psyche in the mountain valley, bright face brimming over with joy. My terrible temptation came back, to leave her to that fool-happy dream, whatever came of it, to spare her, not to bring her down from it into misery. Must I be to her an avenging fury, not a gentle mother? And part of my mind now was saying, "Do not meddle. Anything might be true. You are among marvels that you do not understand. Carefully, carefully. Who knows what ruin you might pull down on her head and yours?" But with the other part of me I answered that I was indeed her mother and her father too, all she had of either, that my love must be grave and provident, not slipshod and indulgent, that there is a time for love to be stern. After all, what was she but a child? If the present case were beyond my understanding, how much more must it be beyond hers? Children must obey. It had hurt me long ago when I made the barber pull out the thorn. Had I not none the less done well? I hardened my resolution. I knew now what, which of two things I must do, and no later than on the day which would soon be breaking, provided only that Bardia were not going on the lion hunt, and that I could get him clear of that wife of his. As a man, even in great pain or sorrow, can still be fretted by a fly that buzzes in his face, I was fretted by the thought of this wife, this petted thing, suddenly starting up to delay or to hinder. I lay down on my bed to wait for morning, calmed and quiet in a way, now that I knew what I would do. Chapter 14. It seemed long to me before the palace was stirring, though it stirred early because of the king's hunting. I waited till that noise was well begun. Then I rose and dressed in such clothes as I had worn the day before, and took the same urn. This time I put in it a lamp and a little pitcher of oil, and a long band of linen about a span and a half broad, such as bridesmaids wear in Gloam, wrapped over and over round them. Mine had lain in my chest ever since the marriage night of Psyche's mother. Then I called up Pooby and had food brought to me, of which I ate some, and some I put in the urn under the band. When I knew by the horse hoofs and horns and shoutings that the king's party was gone, I put on my veil and a cloak and went down. I sent the first slave I met to find whether Bardia were gone to the hunting, and if he were in the palace to send him to me. I waited for him in the pillar room. It was a strange freedom to be in there alone, and indeed amid all my cares I could not help perceiving how the house was, as it were, lightened and set at liberty by the absence of the king. I thought from their looks that all the family felt it. Bardia came to me. "Bardia," said I, "I must go again to the mountain." "It's impossible you should go with me, lady," he said. "I was left out of the hunting, ill luck for me, for one purpose only, to watch over the house. I must even lie here at night till the king's back." This dashed me very much. "Oh, Bardia," said I, "what shall we do? I am in great straits. It's on my sister's business." Bardia rubbed his forefinger across his upper lip in a way he had when he was gravelled. "And you can't ride," he said. "I wonder now... But no, that's foolishness. There's no horse to be trusted with a rider that can't ride. And a few days hence won't serve. The best would be to give you another man."
"But, Bardia, it must be you. No one else would be able... It's a very secret errand."
"I could let Gram off with you for 2 days and a night."
"Who's Gram?"
"The small dark one. He's a good man."
"But can he hold his tongue?"
"It's more a question if he can ever loosen it. We get hardly 10 words from him in as many days. But he's a true man, true to me above all, for I once had the chance to do him a good turn.
It will not be like going with you, Bardia.
That's the best you can do, lady, unless you can wait. But I said I could not wait, and Bardia had Graham called. He was a thin-faced man, very black-eyed, and I thought looked at me as if he feared me. Bardia told him to get his horse and await me where the little lane meets the road into the city. As soon as he was gone, I said, "Now, Bardia, get me a dagger."